Good morning, good morning. This is Dave Mazza.
And I'm Joanne Bowman.
And you're listening to Voices from the Edge. Well, we're 7 months into a new administration, and we still find ourselves embroiled in two wars in Asia. Some folks are starting to say, how is this different from the last 8 years? And perhaps more disturbing is it seems that between policymakers and pundits, the national discourse is still stuck in the same rut in describing and talking about what do we do in terms of Iraq, Afghanistan, and U.S. presence in general around the world? Well, we hope to try to tidy that whole thing up today by having a conversation with Tom Hastings of Oregon Peace Institute, who's here with us this morning. Tom has been a longtime peace activist here and is also involved in the Peace Voices program and is responsible for helping pull together a Peace Voice conference that's taking place August 1st. So we're going to talk about the conference, talk about what's happening nationally, what the peace movement is dealing with in trying to move us away from the same old let's do the war thing. So, good morning, Tom. Thank you for joining us.
Morning, Dave. Morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
We want to spend a lot of time talking about the conference, but let's start a little bit about this situation here. A lot of folks are feeling like, this looks an awful lot like the Bush Wars, even though we do have a new person in the White House. Is there a sense that there is real change happening, and is it becoming more difficult now that we have a popular president in office to raise questions like, what are you guys doing over there?
Yeah, I think we've got a number of things working here, not the least of which is the peace community. Peace and justice communities across this country are exhausted after 8 years of being battered and abused by the Bush administration. So we hoped that we could, take a couple minutes to inhale, exhale, and get ready for whatever we need to get ready for. I think for me, one of the incidences from our own history in this country that has meant the most to me is to try to reflect on what happened when Dr. King visited with Kennedy, when Kennedy was president, and basically went there to say, you had all these campaign promises, you're not living up to them. What's the glitch? What's the holdup? And his message was very clear and forceful back to King, saying, you have to bring the people into the streets to force me to do what I want to do, because otherwise I will be slaughtered. Mm-hmm. They'll hand me back my political head on a platter. Mm-hmm. And I think this is potentially, at least, I'm certainly willing still at this point to say that is exactly what we need to do for Obama. We need to present the evidence that allows him to say, uh-oh, I've got to do this thing, or I'm going to have to answer to this very active constituency. So the problem on our side is that we're exhausted. Our hope is that, we finally went through all these months of door-to-door canvassing and everything else on top of the previous 8 years of suffering through these, increasingly constricted free speech zone and just, ignoring us completely. And now we have to do this all over again, only from the standpoint of basically how can we support you to do the right thing that you want to do? I think this is a problem for us.
I think you raise an excellent point because it's almost like a replay of the early Clinton years, right? Because activists had been working hard to change the administration, and you change the administration, activists and lots of folks went home and went, oh, we won, we were successful. Let's go home, put our feet up, and all the changes that we want are just going to magically happen, right? And I've certainly heard President Obama say that over and over and over again. I can only do what you make me do, because I think people forget that there's still lobbyists in Congress every single day pushing back against every progressive agenda item that's on the agenda. And we also have to remember that we send a whole congressional delegation to Congress that actually has a vote, and their votes haven't changed much since the new administration has taken over. So I agree with you. I think that that we forget that the work doesn't actually end on Election Day. It actually really begins on Election Day.
That's absolutely unfair, and that's the reality, unfortunately.
Well, and also, of course, what's your sense in terms of, you know, the economic issues? I mean, we did, you know, since last year with the meltdown, the polling shows that, you know, the economy is still number one issue. It's clearly displaced concern over the war. Is the peace movement finding difficulty even getting people's attention about the war in that respect? I mean, are they too focused on their quickly disappearing retirement accounts and mortgages and what have you?
Well, it was interesting to me that I produced, you know, like many of us, I tried to, be an incessant blogger and do a fair bit of writing. And it was interesting to me that the most accepted, and I always write from a peace perspective, and there's a general disinterest in it until I framed it in its economic frame, which is basically that if you want to create jobs, the least effective way to do that is to give money to the Pentagon. They will create fewer jobs per $1 billion spent than any other. But
they're really well-paying jobs.
they're extremely capital-intensive jobs, so that they are well-paying jobs, but there are very few of them, and they are highly profitable to the owners. So you've got the elite ruling class, which is just cleaning up. You're in, you're out, but we want to blame everything else but. And so that, to me, is part of the job of the peace movement now, is to really work on reframing. This is what Lakoff told us to do back in 2004, and people are slowly learning to reframe things so that people are actually interested. And that's, I think that's all part of this sort of sloshing progress that we all attempt to make.
And that brings us around really to sort of what's at the heart of this Peace Voice conference, isn't it? Part of that is looking at the ways in which we talk about reexamining our attitudes and opinions on war and peace, and basically that, you know, one's good and one's bad, but, you know, how we do that, how do we be more effective with reaching to the media and to the general public, sort of kitchen table type discussions?
Yeah, and the My goal with this was to bring together activists and academics because they really do create a dialectic of sort of increased scholarship that informs increased effectiveness in the activist community, and it really can be mutually beneficial. So we're looking at things from a number of different perspectives, and we've got a number of very interesting, both activists and academics coming. And by the way, the one thing I have gotten better at over the years is begging. So I did manage to raise enough money to make this conference free and open. And I want to really promote everybody's participation in this. This is an interactive. It's not a, you know, here comes the Department of Energy to speak at you, and the question and answer period will be sometime after midnight. But this is, every single presentation will be interactive, and we'll have both plenary sessions and breakout sessions, so that everything that everybody participates in, they will be a participant, and they will be involved in adding to this collaborative learning experience. One of the most dynamic and interesting peace people I've ever met is Barbara Wien. She was the only, she'll be one of our keynote speakers, and she was the only United States Institute of Peace officer who was fired from her job for during the ramp up to the war, invasion and occupation of Iraq. She agitated publicly for the United States Institute of Peace, first internally and then publicly, for them to come out. I mean, this is something serving at the pleasure of the president.
Right.
You know, it's basically a bunch of functionaries for the State Department, and she was saying, we need to publicly oppose this idea of of invading Iraq. So she was first told to shut up, and then she was told to get out. And before that, she had been a real peace scholar and started way back in her early 20s, actually, being published in the academic side of things, and went on to be executive director of the Consortium of Peace Research, Education, and Development. Then after that, went to USIP, and then spent several years as the director of Peace Brigades International, which is the sort of unarmed bodyguards that have had an incredible record in Guatemala, El Salvador, Sri Lanka, Colombia, and other places around the world. And so her experience in the world of activism and the world of the academy, I think, is a real rich combination. So she'll be, and she always knows sort of what's at the very edge of the world of peace and justice. She's the most turned to person I know.
Well, if you're just tuning in, where have you been? You're late. We've been talking here for nearly 15 minutes. But seriously, we're talking this morning with Tom Hastings of the Oregon Peace Institute, in part about changing the national discourse about war and peace in this country, and also talking about the upcoming Peace Voice Conference that's happening here in Portland. We'll give you the specifics here in a little bit, but it is on August 1st. And we want you to join us in this conversation. Give us a call at 503-231-8187.
And so I'm curious as to, you said this is interactive. What is the maximum capacity for the venue that this conference is going to be at?
I think it's Kramer 53, which is the auditorium room at the it's the ground floor when you enter from the Lincoln Hall side, which is the best entrance now because of all the construction at PSU.
Yes, I noticed there's lots of work taking place there.
I know.
Once again, it's
like we're not happy unless unless the air is filled with toxic fumes and we have a hazardous waste site. But it's
that's
so
like
it's
maybe 300, right? 250 to 300 people, right. I think, can fit in there. And it's a good auditorium setting. And then we've got a couple of nice breakout rooms for some of the concurrent sessions.
Well, so what are some of the sessions? I mean, what's the focus of some of the sessions?
Well, for example, we're bringing in Jeff Lays, who is a co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, the group that began as Voices in the Wilderness. They were the ones who busted the sanctions on Iraq all during the 1990s and were arrested, fined, crushed in the federal courts. This is the Kathy Kelly and Jeff Lays organization. Jeff is going to come and talk about how they used media to move their message and provide some other... he's also a really good resource on military budgets. He does very good analysis of that. So he'll be doing a workshop. A Russian scholar named Ksenia Gorbenko will be doing a presentation on imagery and semiotics of campaigns, how to basically push your campaign by learning how to use sort of universally understood symbols that are culturally appropriate. Right. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Pennsylvania and a rising young scholar.
One of the things that you and I talk about a lot when we have an opportunity to talk is how to really get people of color more engaged and involved in peace advocacy kind of activity, because, unfortunately, the peace movement has traditionally been white, middle class, and continues to be that way for the most part. And I know that you really are very mindful of that and are always trying to engage people of color as speakers as well as participants. Do you see that changing anytime soon? Do you see this becoming more of a multiracial, multi-ethnic movement in Oregon? And what are some of your suggestions about how to get us there?
I was
Tom's laughing.
I was
how much time do I have?
I was with you right up until you said in Oregon. Yeah. one of our presenters is Ako Yamakawa, and she's going to be doing a presentation on the indigenous resistance to the U.S. military base in Okinawa. Mm-hmm. And there is a global movement now of indigenous people finally getting unified and offering nonviolent resistance to U.S. military bases. I'm in the middle of an incredible book by an anthropologist named David Vine called Island of Shame about Diego Garcia, which is an island in the Indian Ocean where colonial masters brought African slaves and indentured servants from India. And that was in the 18th century, just to do the, you know, really, really hard work of the copra work, etc. And during World War II, the United States Navy's, quote, visionaries, when you're, you know, running an empire, you've got to have some visionaries who colonize the future. This anthropologist really goes through, he FOIA'd everything and really goes through government records that have finally been declassified. He even had a brief conversation with McNamara and, you know, tried to track down some of the information on the history of the establishment of this U.S. military base on an island that had been colonized by the French and then the British. And this is, you know, it's only one example of many, many bases around the world that have been basically set up by the U.S. at the expense of the indigenous people on the ground. So we'll be looking at that, and we'll be exploring that movement, focusing on Okinawa and her presentation. But I just think that that's one of the strands of the peace movement globally that's the most exciting, because then you've got a complete integration of peace and justice.
Mm-hmm. The other aspect of that, which I find, and again, I agree with you, in Oregon, I think, is a problem, is there's the class issue as well, because again, the peace movement in Oregon is largely middle class, and while there are certainly some efforts to reach out to working class communities and working class organizations, it's pretty limited. And can be very critical because, for example, organized labor is well organized politically often, and their agenda is not always in accord with the peace movement. So are class issues also going to be explored, and how do we transcend those class lines in order to build a movement around peace?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it will be part of several presentations. One of the people, first of all, the three presenters who will be doing a PSU Model UN presentation will be addressing this from the UN standpoint. Their presentation will be on making an economic bill of rights. Something that has been missing for so long from the basic Declaration of Human Rights. So that's the kind of, you know, reform that I think the peace and justice community wants. When everybody talks about reforming the UN, mm-hmm. The John Bolton method, of course, is, you know, his idea of reforming the UN is to line up the whole General Assembly and mow them down. Our idea of reforming the UN is to elevate the General Assembly to be much more powerful than the so-called Security Council, et cetera. And the Economic Bill of Rights really fits in with that. But also we'll have Brian Wilson, who I'm sure both of you know, who's really an American hero. He'll be one of the presenters. And this is a guy who has, his sacrifice is for peace and justice has been so extreme that I just feel like he's always worth listening to. He really has spent most of his adult life, and he just turned 68 on the 4th of July. We just did a big celebration for him. But here is a guy who literally gave his legs for the peace movement and has focused not on producing a middle class peace movement, but has focused on going back to the place where he was sent to kill people, into the so-called third world, the what peace scholar Johann Galtung would call the maldeveloped world rather than the developing world. They developed just fine by themselves before they were interfered with by colonial powers. And he's given himself back to those folks with his entire life. So we're looking forward to hearing from him too.
Well, we're going to go to the phone lines because we have a caller on the line. And if you want to join us in this conversation with Tom Hastings of the Oregon Peace Institute, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. And we have Gregory on the line. Good morning, Gregory.
Good day. Listen, the last time I heard or saw something about something calling itself a peace movement was that the progressives and the peace movement actually went over into the Democratic Party and haven't been seen nor heard of much since then. I think, you know, trying to talk about forming a popular social movement is just going to be rather vacuous unless you talk about some of the issues which have happened in the past year or two. Another point is that, you know, there's no point in advocating people turn themselves into isolated martyrs. You know, there's no sense in encouraging some young woman to go out and lay in front of a bulldozer somewhere. What is needed is a mass social movement. And the conversation here does not seem to point in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you. I wish you had stayed there so that I could ask you what your suggestions would be to create a mass social justice movement.
Well, he just threw that out there. Well, it's good to hear from Gregory. I hadn't heard from him in a long time. But, you know, I know Gregory, and I think I know kind of what he's kind of get at, because his suggestion is unless one, as he says, builds a mass movement, which obviously goes beyond just talking about peace and how do we do that? How do we get peace activists or environmentalists or, you know, fill in the blank to look beyond the confines of their own area and focus of interest?
Yes. Well, I absolutely agree with the caller. I think Gregory makes a wonderful point. This is not about simple witness for peace. This is about creating a mass movement. And when I teach at PSU and at PCC, my ground rule, number one, is everything you do out in the world is a recruiting opportunity. If you don't view it that way,
right,
you're not viewing it in a way that's going to produce any meaningful change.
Isn't that the Amway motto?
Yeah, it's also the model of the military, I'm sure. And so we're in a very competitive environment in terms of recruiting. And so we had better do exactly what the caller said. We had better make this applicable to everybody and make it invitational to everybody. I see the model of nonviolence to me is you heighten the confrontation even as you deepen the invitation. So what you do has got to confront whatever negative behaviors you think that the powers are engaged in. At the same time, you're becoming more and more appealing and less alienating to the average person who's just, you know, going to work every day. They need to look at you and say, that's attractive to me. I like what they're doing. I'm going to maybe be outside my comfort zone, but I'll still be in my safe zone. I want to participate.
You know, I think that you just raised a very valid point. I think the challenge with us building a multiracial, multiethnic, multi-social economic class, social justice movement in this country is that we have a lot of people who want to be king, but no people that actually want to be followers, right? You know, it's like, okay, well, if you don't put my issue in the center of this movement, then it's not about me. And if I don't get deleted, it's not about me. And so I do think that we've got this this real disconnect from people who say that they're all about building a social justice movement, but their unwillingness to actually be a support player and allow other people, other voices that have not been at the forefront to really step in and fill that void so that it really does reflect the multitude of voices that need to be involved and engaged in that effort.
Yeah. The object is to create new generations of leaders, not to, you know,
recycle.
Rule over. Yeah, let's leave the recycling to the Republicans. You know, they keep bringing back oldies like Rumsfeld and Cheney. How many times can you recycle these people?
Well, we only have a few minutes left for this segment, so Tom, we want to make sure that our listeners, have all the details on the conference. And in fact, I should point out to folks that we have put the links to the Peace Voice Conference website and to the Oregon Peace Institute website on our own webpage at kboo.fm/voicesfromtheedge. So you can go there and find that information, and including how to register and how to, you know, what's going on. But look, for those of you who don't have access to a keyboard or just don't like doing that, Tom's going to enlighten us.
Right.
And, well, we've stopped registration. Basically, just show up. Just come on over.
It's anarchy.
It's 2463 Organize for Anarchy. We're opening up our first sessions at 9 in the morning, and we'll be going through all the way until our keynote speakers, including first Brian Wilson and then Barbara Wien, they'll be speaking at, I think, 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then after that, we'll finish up with a concert by Satori, which is it's called Men Singing for Peace. And everything is free and open. There'll be scholars coming from around the country. One very interesting young scholar, Bo Grosskop, is going to be doing a presentation called Strategic Terror on the ethics and the non-ethics of bombing people. This is the kind of presentation that goes more to informing us from his field of philosophy, for example. And then another presentation will be on a sort of a reinterpretation of the Tao. So we'll have some fairly esoteric things. Also, David Ferry Smith will be on hand to read from his book that he wrote after his experiences in Iraq called Battlefield Without Borders. And he'll also be bringing a brand new film, which is an edited compilation of interviews with Iraqi refugees living in Amman, Jordan, and more and more.
And more. Wonderful. Yeah.
So it sounds August 1st.
August 1st.
August 1st.
Kramer 53.
Which is Portland State University, which is on Southwest Broadway, roughly Hall Street, is it?
Yes.
Southwest Broadway and Hall, there's like campus ministries and those buildings there to look out for, as well as the campus itself.
Right.
You can find it.
Kramer Hall
53.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Tom. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show and to find out what you're up to.
Thank you, David.
Yep, we're looking forward to a big turnout on August 1st. In the meantime, you just get this whole War and Peace thing settled for us, would you?
Right. We'll be expecting that on August 1st.
Things to do today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. That's Tom Hastings, Oregon Peace Institute, and Peace Conference 2009 coming, Peace Voice Conference 2009 coming up on August 1st. So, like I say, check out our website. We've got all the contact information there. And we're going to do a segue here.
Yes.
To
healthcare reform.
Something that we've been talking a lot about recently with good reason.
Yes, for very good reason. And we're going to be joined by Betsy Diller, who is the Healthcare for America Now director here in Oregon. And if she may actually be in the studio or very quickly trying to get this way. I guess one thing that people may know is that, you know, there are a bazillion proposals, healthcare proposals, that are working their way through Congress. The president was on TV last night really making the case for why we need to get healthcare reform done before the August recess. And that's actually, I think, probably one of the most important pieces for the public to know. there are three different committees that have bills that are working their way through for the first time in like a generation. Two House committees have actually voted out legislation that actually sets the framework for healthcare reform moving forward at the national level. We're still waiting for a revenue bill to come out. And the goal is to have all three of those bills voted on prior to the August recess, when our congressional delegation will be back in Oregon taking their break before the fall heats up. As the president said, his goal was to have all those bills passed out of committee, passed on the floors, so that after the August recess in September, there would be the reconciliation process. So they would take the best of, well, hopefully, the best of the bills that had been passed, squash them together, and come up with a meaningful bill that actually will move us towards providing health care for not only the 46 million people who don't have health care in this country, but also for the hundreds of millions of people who are underinsured at this time. And I think one of the things that I know we wanted to talk about today was about the Health Equity and Accountability Act of 2009, which is a piece of legislation that Congresswoman Donna Christensen introduced last month to actually make sure that in any healthcare reform legislation that would be passed this session, that they would start addressing the issues of disparities in health outcomes. We spent a lot of time in Oregon at the state legislature really educating legislators and other healthcare allies about the need to invest money to ensure that people of color health outcomes got better and not worse, not exacerbated by healthcare reform.
And that actually hasn't percolated out through, at least the in terms of media reporting on this whole national healthcare reform. You hear very little discussion of the disparity issue. I mean, the focus has been on cost and right. public options and things like that, but not the question. And of course, the general throwing out that there's 46 million Americans without insurance.
Right.
But
well, no, you're absolutely right. But you know, the good news is that under the leadership of Representative Wu and the House Tri-Committee Caucus, we have in fact been moving this issue through the legislation that's under consideration. So a lot of the components, like improving workforce diversity, ensuring that culturally and linguistically appropriate healthcare services are available, strengthening data collection, ensuring accountability and improved evaluations, those pieces actually are in the healthcare bills that are moving through Congress at the moment.
I would anticipate the idea of bolstering efforts to ensure culturally and linguistically appropriate healthcare and remove language and cultural barriers to healthcare. That element of the act is going to be a lightning rod for the right, since they are going to say, ah, that is code. We're trying to give health care to illegal immigrants.
Well, you know, one of the shameful parts of all the health care legislation that's moving at the national level, not only are they not addressing undocumented immigrants and
right.
providing health care for them, but they have the appalling focus on removing health care for legal residents for 5 years. And so it's I mean, the insanity. I mean, I thought it was bad here in Oregon, but then you look at what's happening at the national level. So they're actually writing language in all these bills currently that actually take away rights that legal residents in this country have now. You may remember in January, under the S-CHIP bill, we actually were able to remove the 5-year bar mm-hmm. for immigrant children that were here undocumented parents, right? And so because we kept asking the question, so why do you need a 5-year bar? Why do you need a 5-year bar for people who are in the country going through the right process in order to make that happen? And so, yeah, so that's the bad news. The bad news is that none of the bills that are moving through actually are trying to make sure that everyone has health care when they need it at a cost they can afford. Hi, Betsy. How are you?
That's the good news is our guest, Betsy Dillard, has arrived.
Sorry, I had some car trouble this morning.
I've been filling in for you, Betsy.
That's right.
And probably not doing as effective a job as you could do. And so... All I've done so far, now I've just lost my voice.
You need to see a doctor there.
Well, a couple of ways, yeah, I need to see a doctor today.
That's really what this whole healthcare thing's about with you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right, I have a personal stake, as we all do, in fixing our healthcare system. So welcome, Betsy.
Thank you for having me.
It is our pleasure to have you here. I just was telling people that there were three bills moving through. I haven't given them much detail. I actually was talking about the Health Equity and Accountability Act as you stepped in. And so what do you think people need to know about the bills that are moving through Congress?
Well, I think that they need to know that it is not a done deal, that even though we made historical progress in the past week of getting it out of three committees and hopefully soon out of four, that this is a step that we haven't taken in the past, that this has been trying. We've been trying to do this as a country for 60 years, and we have moved farther than we ever have this week in passing it out of the, Education and Labor, Ways and Means, and the Help Committee in the Senate. And the Energy and Commerce is probably going to get it out by the end of the week. But the House bill is a really great bill as far as, you know, advocates for the public option, real affordability, keeping the health insurance industry honest, increasing quality, reducing costs. It's a decent bill. And like you said, there are a few things that we'd like to see changed on it. You know, removing the 5-year bar for Medicaid for documented immigrants, and we'd like to see the affordability standards a little bit stronger. But all in all, it's a really decent bill. And so the Energy and Commerce Committee is still in markup, and they're expecting to pass it by the end of the week, and we're expecting a House floor vote by next Wednesday. So if you haven't contacted your member of the House here in Portland, that's Congressman Blumenauer or Congressman Wu, to say thank you because they both voted for it out of their respective committees, I would certainly encourage folks to do that. So the next big step is a Finance Committee, which is where our Oregon Senator Ron Wyden sits. They're expected to have a bill out pretty much as we speak, a draft bill, and they're going to be going through markup in the next couple days. They're hoping to have it done by next Tuesday. But as we all know, all these things are always subject to change based on the political will and whether people want to have temper tantrums halfway through. So things are moving really quickly. The finances where we think we're going to have a bit of a problem. Mm-hmm. that's where, you know, a lot of folks are dead set on making sure that there's bipartisan support, which is great. However, we don't want to be sacrificing decent policy for bipartisan support.
Right. And we certainly have a senior senator that's so bent on having bipartisan support that the proposals that come up seem to be more of a wink, wink, nod, nod to the insurance companies rather than a true commitment to making sure that we're insuring folks with health coverage. I know people are probably, it's like, how many times can you throw a trillion point six? You know, people are probably just kind of glazing over when they think about the magnitude of the dollars that we're talking about healthcare reform. Betsy, can you help kind of put that in perspective? Because, I mean, we certainly gave more to that to the banks, right?
And
to so could you give us some kind of perspective about what we think the cost is going to be, and really what does that mean to taxpayers, right, over the short term and long term?
Well, you know, President Obama talked about this in his press conference last night. It's going to be paid for. Cannot add to the deficit over a 10-year period. And actually, I know this gets way underreported, but the House bill was scored in its entirety from the CBO with a $6 billion surplus over 10 years.
Yeah, I read that. I think
in
this morning's paper. Yeah.
It's something that doesn't get reported much. You know, the CBO took a lot of the bills, and it takes time. These people are not machines, right? They're actual people looking through the bill. So little by little, as they take pieces, it's $1 trillion. Oh, it's $1.3 trillion. Oh, no, it's 600. But over the long term, it's $6 billion surplus. And honestly, the reason that it costs so much is for reason for subsidies, mm-hmm. for working families, mm-hmm. for the expansion of Medicaid. So those very low-income folks that really can't afford to pay anything for their health insurance. The affordability standards for people like you and me are the things that make this expensive. Mm-hmm. So when you start talking about decreasing the amount that it's going to cost, that means decreasing the help that you're going to get. Mm-hmm. To do that, so
or the number of people that are covered, right?
Right. Right. Or the number of people that are covered because they, quite frankly, just can't afford it. Right. So we think that the House bill is a really good bill. It has progressive financing, mm-hmm. so the people who pay for this are the employers who want to provide coverage. Of course, small business owners are exempt from that, mm-hmm. And also the 1.3% wealthiest. Americans who can't afford to pay a little extra so that the rest of us can get health care reform.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Voices from the Edge, and Joanne and I are speaking this morning with Betsy Dillard of Health Care for Americans Now.
Yes.
And that's the national organization. She's with the Oregon chapter, the national organization advocating and trying to make this big push to get something through the Congress here. As we're approaching this critical junction in terms of trying to reform our healthcare system. And if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. But before we go back to Betsy, just want to remind you why you need to keep listening to KBOO this morning. At 9, Teresa Mitchell and Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, on A Deeper Look, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. At 10, Chris Andre and Liam Delta host Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, reports from the Honduran capital and Mexico about the military coup in Honduras. Also, an interview with the author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And at 11, you'll hear Between the Covers, a weekly show featuring interviews with locally and nationally known authors of both fiction and nonfiction. All that and more coming up this morning on KBOO 90.7 FM. Well, let's go back to Betsy. One of the problems that is not just this, you know, in terms of the Republicans appear to have a strategy of just saying, just say no. They love that for everything, you know, teen pregnancy, drugs, and healthcare reform, apparently. But there's also some real concern about, you know, one of the problems with having a vast majority, a party having a vast majority in Congress is you pick up a lot of fairly conservative members of your party, and there's an awful lot of shaky Democrats all around this, isn't there? And do we have some certain problems? Do we have any problems in Oregon in terms of Democrats who aren't necessarily with the program?
Well, I'd say in the House, I think that our Democrats and our House delegation are all there with us. You know, every single one of them has come out in support of this bill. There are some issues with the Medicare reimbursement rate, which we all know that Oregon gets sort of the low end of, and so they're working very hard in making sure that that's addressed, and that's certainly an issue for a lot of the conservative Democrats across the country. But in the Senate, we have Jeff Merkley, who is a wonderful progressive man who has been fighting very hard to make this bill in the Help Committee as strong as it can, and we should certainly be thanking him for his leadership there. Senator Wyden is problematic. I want to be sort of fair to him because he has been working so hard on healthcare reform long before anybody else has. However, he's really just not with the rest of us at this point. It's like everybody else has caught up to him and plus some
more. The parade has passed him
by.
That's right.
And so, you know, he has some really great things like, you know, really keeping the insurance industry you know, regulated and making sure that they can't do the things that they want. He's a really strong advocate for affordability. But the things that we think that are the cornerstones of the healthcare reform, and that is a robust national day one public option. He keeps saying that he's open to it if it's responsibly financed or sustainably financed. I'm sorry. And you know, our response to that is, you know, you're on the finance committee. You're the one that decides whether this is responsibly financed, right. And also that the House has put together a bill that has a robust public option, that is responsibly and sustainably financed, And so it's working, and it's getting the centrist Democrats. And quite frankly, like I said, bipartisanship is an amazing thing. Republicans are not the devil, as much as we'd like to think that they are sometimes.
Oh, we have photos and proof. But, I'm sorry.
But we certainly do not want to sacrifice good policy that right. is going to create quality, affordable health care for everybody in this country. For bipartisanship.
That's right. And I think, Betsy, that you are much more polite than I am, because I actually think that there's some real arrogance around not doing what clearly most Oregonians and most people around the country have really rallied behind, right? I mean, it's like at some point you've got to give up what your bill was and get with the program about what really does make sense for most people in this country. And it is a bit of arrogance to think just because you've done it for 30 years and you've never been able to get it this far, why would you think that now all of a sudden your bill is going to be the one that's actually going to sail through Congress?
Let me in for just one more play, Coach.
I know my bill's the right one. I just know it is.
We're going to go back to the phone lines because we have a caller. And if you want to join us in this conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Joanne and I are talking with Betsy Dillard of Healthcare for Americans Now about the current status of healthcare reform. And we have Jim on the line. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Everything that any and all of you said is wonderful. And it's so good to hear Betsy and the clear presentation. It's optimistic, and it's about time that we were able to feel some optimism about this. The thing I wanted to mention was that I understand that there's an amendment by Dennis Kucinich on the House bill, at least until yesterday, that allows states individually to experiment with single-payer systems. Because I think single-payer systems is, a single-payer system is where we will end up if we suddenly get rational.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Yeah. Dennis Kucinich actually proposed an amendment in the Education and Labor Committee last week, which passed... that says that two states per year can adopt a single payer system if they so desire, mm-hmm. their state legislator and their governor and everybody else. We think it's a great bill, mm-hmm. that was passed with a lot of hard work from a lot of single payer advocates. Bernie Sanders has a similar amendment, which I believe still hasn't been voted on. So if you want to call folks and get them to support that, it's certainly. As we all know, that's the way Canada got their single-payer system, is mm-hmm. that one of the provinces decided to do it on their own, and the rest of the country was like, oh, wait, we're not all going to turn into communists because we have a single-payer system. So, yeah, no, it's a very good bill, or it's a very good amendment, and it passed very, very quickly. So,
well, Jim does raise an issue. I know that I don't want to characterize KABU listeners in any one way, but I would say that... it's a safe bet that a very significant portion of KABU listeners are strong advocates of single payer. And I've certainly heard from some saying, you know, they're just sort of washing their hands of what they consider this current sellout because it's too much compromise. And it's just, you know, if we adopt this, we'll never get single payer. What do you say to people who are saying that, who are saying that, you know, if we don't get single payer, we shouldn't be engaged in this struggle right now at all?
Well, I think that you look at the struggles of the fact that this is not a done deal, yeah. and that we think that the House bill is a strong bill, and there are certainly ways that it could be stronger, but that we don't even know if we're going to be able to get as strong of a House bill. Mm-hmm. That there are so many people getting cold feet about this bill, and that we are working like hell to get this thing passed. If this thing passes, it will significantly change the ability for people to access quality, affordable health care reform. Mm-hmm. And if people get the option, we think that if people get the option of a public plan that shows that government can do health care, that you're not going to be you know, a bureaucrat is not going to be sitting in the doctor's room with you with his tie telling the doctor what you can and cannot do. People are going to... Oh, I was going to say, people are still going to vote with their feet, necessarily, right, and go to the public plan. And if they don't go to the public plan, then they're going to be forced to compete with private insurers, and the private insurers are not going to be able to operate in a way that they do now, because they have to compete with that public option. And if that means that some of the ones that are inefficient and are too greedy, that they might go out of business. It's true. Some of them might. But the ones that are left around are going to be the ones that have shown that they're going to give people quality, affordable access to health care when they need it. Mm-hmm. And so people are very scared. I mean, we live in Portland, and a lot of folks are I think sometimes take a really big picture view here, but there are a lot of people out there scared of losing what they have. We have this astronomical number of 46 million people uninsured. Well, right, that still means that 75% of America is insured,
right,
and that they do have access.
Right. How many of those are underinsured?
Right. How many of those are underinsured? Right. That's the thing, is but they're terrified.
That's right.
They're terrified. That is what the Republicans are telling them, is that what you have now,
right,
even though it sucks,
right,
but you don't know it sucks yet,
right,
because you haven't gotten sick,
right,
you can keep it. Because
right,
otherwise, if you don't have that ability, people are going to, they're going to freak out, and they're going to think that they're losing their health care coverage to cover the poor. And
right,
we all know that the uninsured is not the poor either.
That's right.
But that's sort of, it's the American... the American way.
Well, and it's actually, I mean, I think part of it is, I think you would agree, Betsy, that a lot of the folks that have been working on the current healthcare proposals would love to have seen a single-payer system. But the political reality is that there were not enough votes to actually move a single-payer system through mm-hmm. Congress at this time, right? And so you can blame the people working on healthcare for America now for not being champions of a single-payer system, or you could accept the political reality of moving a hybrid system forward will actually force, as Betsy said, some insurance companies to go out of business, because quite frankly, they don't deserve to be in business, and it will force the rest of them to get better. And there will be a public option that people will have the option of opting into. And I think that's the best possible scenario based on where we are right now and the people who say they serve us and our current Congress.
Well, I'm going to say it's all Betsy's fault instead. But we are going to go back to the phone lines because we have just a minute or two left here, and we want to get our caller in. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. I wanted to say that I think that we should only hold out for a single payer, because any compromise will be written in such a way so that the public plan will, by design, be an inferior plan, and people will not pick that, or the public plan will be an unfunded plan. And I just don't see why our politicians that we elected with a mandate don't stand up, like Blumenauer and our senators, you know, and say, hey, this is the cheapest plan, and it does cover everybody, and it's real simple. Why not just do single payer? If they were doing the publicity for it in the PR, we would have a lot better chance.
Okay, Mark, we're going to have to leave you at that there because of time, but I would he did raise one other facet of that. Is there, with the public option, are we ensuring that these aren't, are they ensuring the plans that are coming out of Congress providing realistic and adequate funding for a public option?
Yes, well, the public option would be funded mostly by people paying into it, like a premium.
Mm-hmm. So it would be a robust alternative.
It is a robust alternative, and we understand his concern about it being underfunded or being undercut or those sorts of things. We've had that worry the entire time while we've been thinking about concepts, and we're still worried about it coming out of the Finance Committee. But in this House bill, it is set up in a way that it will actually compete with private insurers, and that it is an actually good product that people can go to. It is certainly a concern that, and it's still coming out of the Senate Finance Committee. So please, by the end of the week, please contact Ron Wyden and tell him that a robust public option is is the only public option, and not a co-op, and not a regional, and not a this, and not right. a that, a national public option that everybody can choose.
Well, we have put on our website, kboo.fm/voicesfromtheedge, links to Healthcare for Americans Now. But if folks wanted to get involved in this big push to not just for the short-term August goal, but for the longer term of seeing something come to fruition, how do they get involved? How do they get involved with your organization or elsewhere?
Well, email is the best way. Obviously, that if you go to the website and sign up for email alerts, you'll get on an Oregon list, so you will get Oregon updates about what we're doing here, probably as well as national updates. But tonight, there are friends over at Move On are having a rally in Pioneer Square at 7 p.m. For the public option. So if you're there, be there, be loud. We've got a lot of things coming up. We've got Canvas Days, we've got rallies, we've got forums, we've got, you know, our members are coming home next week. Mm-hmm. Remember that. So a lot of them hold town halls. DeFazio is holding town halls. Senator Wyden and Merkley always hold town halls. Congressman Wu holds town halls. Find out where they are, when they're at. You can email me. I have all the list of them. Make sure that they go, and the folks that are behind us, make sure that you're thanking them, because they're working overtime to make sure that this thing passes. And the thing, those that are not with us, make sure that they hear it too.
And that email address is?
Betsy, B-E-T-S-Y, at NIFCO, which is N as in Nancy, W, F as in Frank, C as in Cat, O.org, Betsy at NIFCO.org.
And if we have people who just don't like keyboards, how do they call you?
They can call me at the office at 971-634-0005.
Well, I think we're just about at the end of the road here, but we wanted to thank Betsy Dillard of Healthcare for America Now to join us this morning, bring us up to date on what's going on. And we also want to thank Tom Hastings, who was with us earlier, to talk about the Peace Voice Conference. And so that pretty much should fill our listeners' calendar up for the next few weeks.
That's
here,
true.
I think.
If you want to work for peace, you've got some options to work for peace. You want to work for healthcare, you've got options to work for healthcare reform. I'm Joanne Bowman.
And I'm Dave Mazza.
And you've been listening to Voices from the Edge. We'll see you next week.
Have a good day now.